93.2.
In a totalitarian state, there is, by definition, room for only a single faith. One people, one Reich, one God, one church. And that church was to be the National Socialist Church, which intended to replace the altar with crossed swords and a copy of Mein Kampf. The worst seller, which became a bestseller after Hitler came to power, and made him a millionaire within a year. The cross was to be replaced by the swastika. The German word for swastika is Hakenkreuz, literally hooked cross. So every time you saw it or said it, you were aware that the ubiquitous symbol of the Third Reich was a denial of the Christian cross, a perversion of it.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Russian Su-24 supersonic bomber brought down by the Turkish F-16s, violating airspace or a stab in the back. Are any British politicians really in touch with the British people as they decide whether to bomb Syria or not to bomb? And which of the four sides will we be on if the RAF get into dogfights with the Russian Air Force? Who's going to shoot down who? What about the longer game? NATO and their political wing, the Bilderberg power elite, are playing here. We've seen regime change in Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, Syria, soon perhaps. But then, what about Moscow? What about Beijing? Why not regime change there too? Well, we hear some evidence tonight that that's exactly what the Pentagon is planning. Easy for them to dream over in the US of overthrowing Putin from the comfort of Washington. But will European leaders go along with it? One of the English language's greatest journalists of all time, John Piljoe, has not been on British television talking about this, but we hear from him tonight looking at Syria and who's winning out in the war on terror. But to begin with, we speak to former counter-terrorism officer John Banks. John, hi and welcome to the Politics Show.
Hi, Johnny. Glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
First of all, I'd just like to get your view on the shoot down of the Su-24 this week, because I know it is really the first time since the Cold War that we've had NATO and Russia starting to shoot at each other. Actually, I mean, it would be very easy for Mr. Putin to bang his fist on the table and say, that's an act of war.
Well, basically, yes. It's still disputed whose airspace the aircraft was in. If it was in Russian Turkish airspace, it was there for 17 seconds, which is certainly not enough time for an F-16 to catch it, intercept it, and fire a rocket at it. So it is nonsense to say that it was not an act of war. It was an act of war. It was a deliberate thing, and to anyone who looks at it, it was obviously an ambush. The intercept could not have happened that quickly, in 17 seconds. Absolutely impossible.
Now, each side is saying to the other one, this is a provocation. The Russians were provoking the Turks by flying into our airspace, and the Russians are saying that the Turks were provoking us by shooting our jet down.
Well, I'm an old Cold War warrior, so I'm not a great lover of Russian, although now the Cold War's over and the USSR is finished. Russia seems to be coming out a lot better now. But for the Turks to have an F-16 very close, where it could come up the back end of an Su-24, launch a missile and bring it down that quickly is an impossibility. It was an ambush. There's now talk that the Americans leaked the flight route, which the Americans had been given by the Russians, of the Su-24. The thing was, previous week to this, the Russians had flown the same corridor and struck at ISIS oil tankers. The area they were operating in was an area that ISIS uses to carry all through into Turkey and to bring weapons, equipment and recruits back the other way out of Turkey. So it's an established route. The Turkmen militia are the enemy of the Syrian legitimate government, Bashar al-Assad. Whether we think he's a dictator or not, he is a sovereign head of state. So Turkey has shown its hands here. It's been the most ridiculous act by Turkey. It's shown its hands. It's having to admit, and the Russians are now going to expose what they know about the oil trafficking. Turkey's had to admit that they are operating with Turkish militants, in the Turkmen militants, in that area of Syria. And the fact that the guy with the beard in the video over the body of the dead pilot happens to be the son of a Turkish mayor. It's just been released.
John, I introduced you at the top of the hour as a former counter-terrorism officer. Can you just give us a bit, who are you to talk about this? Give us a bit about your background.
Okay, ex-British paratrooper and pathfinders, worked for Her Majesty's government in a certain department for a period of time. Went to the USA, worked with Oliver North in Honduras, worked for the US in various parts of Africa, was with DEA for 5 years investigating into Pakistan and Colombia, went to South Africa and served 20 years with the Directorate of Special Operations as a colonel. As an intelligence officer, my mandate was narco-terrorism, investigating terrorist financing via narcotics. Now retired.
Yes, I think you've been through quite a lot there. Tell us about what's your general thoughts about how to resolve things in Syria. I mean, I'm rather concerned. We're now on the brink of another Iraq. There are excuses being drummed up for us to get involved again in regime change in the Middle East. We've decided, for whatever reason, that Bashar al-Assad has got to go. Actually, uh-huh. It's no business of the British government to decide
absolutely
that he's got to go. And yet there seems to be building up a case for it. So what are your thoughts about the last couple of weeks and the big attack on Paris and the threat, apparent threat, that there is supposedly from Syria?
Well, the threat isn't coming from Syria, i.e. the Syrian government. The threat is certainly coming from the terrorist groups in there. But it's a very interesting piece on Paris, Tony. I did study it fairly well, as much information as one's capable of getting in civilian life. There were five targets: the Bataclan Hall, the Stade de France, the Casa Nostra, the Caroline Bar, and Bel Equipe Bar. Five targets, separated in an area of roughly 4 square kilometres. Now, what we're being told by the French is there were 7 attackers, only 7, 3 strike teams. Now, I find it amazing that 7 attackers, of which 3 blew themselves up at the Bataclan Hall, and 1 was shot at the Bataclan Hall, that leaves 3, take out that many targets. Have you heard any update on how many actual attackers there were?
Well, no, I haven't, no. But so you're saying that you think that there is some sort of misinformation being given? I mean, I can tell you for a fact, certainly we were told that evening when it happened that the French borders were being closed, while at the same time people were flying backwards and forwards and going on the Eurostar, the French borders were not closed. We were also told the next morning that all of the attackers had been killed, and then we were also being told by eyewitnesses that the police were telling them that they hadn't caught the attackers. So there's a vast mismatch between what is being announced through the international media and what people on the ground are saying.
Yeah, because, it's an impossibility for 7 people, regardless how well trained they were or anything else, to have done 5 targets. Impossible. Any, even special ops guys will tell you that. Now, the other thing is, they were well equipped. The ones that did attack were fluid. They went for their targets. They had no fear in them. They believed in what they were doing. 1,000,000% those people believed in what they were doing, and they believed in the cause they were doing it for. But they were instructed from somewhere else to do this. absolutely no doubts. They didn't suddenly sit down and come up with the idea, let's attack all these targets and have all the equipment and weapons ready. So someone somewhere instructed them to do it. And it would have had to come from the top of ISIS, up in the top of ISIS. Now, most people in the intelligence services will reluctantly tell you that ISIS is is a product of the USA, Saudi and Israel, absolutely no doubts whatsoever. And if we look back in history at al-Baghdadi, we see pictures of him with McCain, the US senator, all having a happy dinner and everything else in the very start of ISIS in 2007 and 2008. Paris created yet more Islamophobia, yet more attacks on Islam or mosques and everything else. The average 88% of Muslims are perfectly good, law-abiding people who have a religion that they're entitled to. They go about their daily life without any problems. That's the ones in Europe. But this has caused a massive backlash, and people are happy with this backlash. The people, it allows increased surveillance states, it allows all sorts of restrictions on movements, and it tightens down most things. But unfortunately, the innocent Muslims are going to be targets now for a very long time.
Now, John, if you had the ear of the Defence Secretary, Philip Hammond, when various people are pulling in different directions with him, trying to persuade him to get involved, particularly the United States, with bombing Syria, with our jets flying over there, what would you be saying to him?
No, absolutely not. The only people who are legitimately allowed to be bombing in Syria are the Russians and the Syrians. Anybody else is conducting a violation of airspace and an act of war. They want to bomb Iraq, fine, but the Iraqi government, I believe, is starting to pull away from the American coalition at the moment, although the Americans have threatened to call in the IMF loans off of Iraq now and bankrupt Iraq unless Iraq keeps using the Americans and the coalition. But nobody has the right to go in to Syria and bomb Syrian territory. We've seen recently that the Americans have yet again bombed a school and another hospital in the last few days. Why is it the Russians we're not hearing about civilian casualties? The Americans tried to say they hit hospitals, but then Medicine Sans Frontières and the Red Cross all said no, they haven't hit any hospitals whatsoever. The Russians are doing pinpoint accuracy with their bombing.
Is one of the reasons that the Russians have not been more vocal about having their jets shot down, John, do you think it's something to do with the Bosphorus? Because the Russians definitely need to be able to go through the Bosphorus, through Turkey, through Istanbul, basically, to get in and out of the Mediterranean and in and out of the Black Sea, don't they?
That's correct, the Black Sea ports. But now the Romanian Black Sea ports, which used to be heavy for Russia, with the Russian fleets in there, Romania is now part of the EU or NATO, I'm not quite sure which, but it's certainly pulled away, and it's closing down the ports to Russia now, their naval facilities there. But Erdogan is going, he is attempting to be the big brave man there. And the only thing he is being big and brave about is the fact that he's got NATO sitting behind him. If it's a provocation to get Russia's been bombing the right people, much to the annoyance and causing damage. They've caused more damage in 8 weeks than the Americans have caused in a year and a half, and the American-led coalition have caused in a year and a half.
I guess bring our old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers in here. Martin, what are your thoughts about what's been going on, particularly this week, with the Russians last week actually bombing the petrol convoys? I noticed those little leaflets that they saw one of those online, that they drop leaflets on the tanker convoys just before they're about to bomb them, and a little leaflet that shows a picture of a Russian jet and the drivers of the tankers running away from the tanker, saying, in 40 minutes time we're going to bomb your tanker, please run away from it now.
Can I just say, I think I understand that was Americans who did that. The Russians are just hitting the tankers. And what Lavrov, who's the Russian foreign minister, has been saying, and the evidence is overwhelming, is that Bilal Erdogan, who is the son of Recep Erdogan, the president of Turkey, has been a major profiteer working with ISIS to bring oil out of Syria.
Uh-huh.
And in actual fact, everybody in the Middle East who's serious, you know, people who write for serious newspapers in Lebanon and so on, everybody knows that MIT, the Turkish intelligence services, have been hand in glove with ISIS all the way.
Yes, and have been helping or facilitating the supply of arms and equipment.
Indeed. And of course, if you remember the Suruk bombing of the Kurdish militants in June or July,
yeah,
and then the bombing in Ankara that killed 100 people at that Kurdish peace demonstration, virtually everybody who's opposed to Erdogan in Turkey, and there's a lot of people who support him, he's got support, but he's got people who are opposed to him, particularly in the eastern part of the country, in the Kurdish part of the country. Mm-hmm. They immediately pointed the finger at the government and at MIT for being behind those bombings, and the PKK have got their own intelligence operation. They identified two Turkish intelligence officers who they believed were behind the attack and assassinated them, which then broke their ceasefire with the Turkish government, which had been running for up to 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
So, if Britain does get involved, for example, I mean, the Americans have been supplying some weaponry to the PKK or the Kurdish Defense Militias in northern Syria, and I understand now that 50 US special forces have gone into Syria to liaise with those people. Now, those people are already in direct combat with the Turkish military, in other words, in combat with NATO. Now, are those special forces that the US has infiltrated into Syria to liaise with the Kurdish militias, are they going to be in combat with NATO? It's all getting very, very bizarre.
It's getting absolutely bizarre. Nobody knows really on the ground. I mean, there's been all this talk of the moderate groups that are fighting ISIS and the FSA that's fighting ISIS, which is all rubbish. The only people who are doing anything against ISIS are the Kurds, as we saw at Kobani and places like that. But you don't really know who is fighting who there, and it's got very dangerous in the skies above Syria, and it isn't long before, yes, there will be a dogfight up there. Americans will open fire, or Russians will open fire on Americans. Americans will open fire on Russians. The British will be flying around, buzzing around, trying to do that, their bit. The Saudis will come in, and it's got pretty horrific.
John, let me just ask you again. You know, so if I'm Philip Hammond, you're my advisor. What would you tell me is the your prognosis? Where is this heading? I'm assuming maybe over the next few weeks there may be a vote in the Houses of Parliament, because there seems to be a lot of MPs who have had their arms twisted and may be going for this, a little bit like Tony Blair in Iraq, going to go for this. If we do go for it, where is this all heading?
It's heading for another Iraq. It's heading for another sovereign head of state being removed by a NATO coalition, just like Gaddafi was, just like Saddam was, which have both led to horrific messes in the Middle East. And that is where it's going to go.
But hang on, are the Russians going to stand for that?
No, they aren't, which is going to lead to a very large conflict that none of us really want to see. But whether the Russians and NATO will just back off in the end and just sit away glaring at each other and let the people in the middle fight it out, the Syrians and the rebels, I'm not sure. I doubt it very much.
Well,
I think that everybody, NATO, should back away from Syria, leave it alone, let the Russians do it, And if anyone's to control a joint effort, let the Russians control the joint effort. And I'm not a communist or Russian lover or anything like that. They are doing a far more professional job at the moment than anybody else.
Well, obviously, I agree with that, John. I think that's clearly, and I think most British public opinion, for example, overwhelmingly supported the Russian intervention in Syria, despite all of the propaganda against it. And of course, bombs are dangerous things, whoever's using them.
Well, you may call it propaganda, but one of the things that's convinced many people, particularly these MPs for some reason, is the threat to Britain by jihadis.
Well, can I just come in on that one? We've talked earlier about the attacks in Paris. The attacks in Paris looked to me very similar to the Gladio style attacks we've seen before.
100%.
I mean, in 1993, the Algerian GIA, the Group Islamic Armée, attacked the metro in Paris, killed 9 people. But of course, all of the investigations subsequently showed, and it was in the case in Algeria itself, that the GIA was a counter gang set up by the Algerian military to discredit their Islamist rebel opponents.
Yeah.
And this is, and you will understand, John, but a lot of the audience still struggle with this, and certainly our MPs struggle with this. Things are not always what they seem.
Definitely not.
And when something like this happens, the French are basically having their chain pulled and told, we need you to do something for us. And of course, Hollande went to talk to Putin, and Putin's open to discussing why don't we have a joint coalition, but they won't drop the idea of getting rid of Assad.
Yeah.
Now, Assad, whatever his rights or wrongs, he did in fact win an election not 2 years ago in Syria. The West ignored it, but the fact is, and NATO,
He's actually won 4 elections.
Well, indeed, and the point is, he's got enough support to continue doing what he's doing.
Well, yeah. Look, hang on a minute.
There's no way he can be just wished away.
Martin, many people will say, hang on a minute, because there was only a very small part, mainly around Damascus, that was actually able to hold an election.
Well, in fact, in Lebanon, what happened in France and in Britain is that Syrians in exile were not allowed to vote in the election. They said they wouldn't allow the embassy to allow them to vote. Whereas in Lebanon, where many Syrian refugees are, they were allowed to vote, and they turned up in their hundreds of thousands to vote for Assad. Now, I'm not suggesting that he's universally loved. I think in certain places like Homs and Aleppo, he's not very well liked. But NATO had an internal document which was leaked, which was their own assessment of the balance of forces on the ground. And their own internal assessment was that 70% of the population were, however reluctantly, supportive of the government. The rebels had the support of about 5%, and the rest were in the middle and didn't know. Now, the fact is, Assad has got enough support on the ground, especially in the minority communities, the Alawites, the Christians, and so on. And the Syrian Arab army used to have Sunni officers. He's actually got enough support to carry on fighting. And I think if it does come to the British RAF facing off against the Syrian Arab army, which has taken 60,000 casualties in the last 4 years, and the Russian military, they will be the ones who will end up in the drink.
Now, John, I notice also that the S-400 anti-aircraft missiles are now coming into Syria.
Oh, yeah.
These are the top-notch Russian to take down possibly even our RAF jets.
Oh, they will, but if we go back on history, what is interesting is to look up Bashar al-Assad's father, Hafez al-Assad, and his uncle, Rifa al-Assad, who was heading the intelligence services. Now, I knew both Hafez and Rifat because of dealings in the Bekaa Valley for the Americans. The Americans loved Hafez al-Assad and Rifa al-Assad, although they didn't make it popular, but the CIA used them to smuggle weapons, and Ollie North, and I was actually present in some of these things, Ollie North actually used Syria to take weapons into Iran during the Contra-Iran affair. Reagan was very happy with Hafez al-Assad. Now, when Bashar came to power, he replaced, and I mean, Syria, Damascus, yes, Syria was bad in those days. Good Lord, yes, horrific with the secret police. Bashar came to power and wanted to bring in a democracy, but as usual, He started peacefully, and then the riots started in various places. The police cracked down on the riots. There were shootings coming from both sides, so everybody immediately blamed Bashar al-Assad as a dictator. Certainly, he had a very hard struggle to bring things together, but if you look at it, Muammar Gaddafi had the most successful country in Africa at one point. But he was a dictator. His security services would crack down on any dissent. Saddam Hussein, his country was running well. It had arguments with the Kurds and with the Iranians at one point. But he cracked down on dissent, but his people were in the general happy. Iran, yeah, okay, it's a very strict regime, but the people are genuinely happy. They're fed, they've got medical supplies, they've got all of this sort of thing. The same was going to happen in Syria under Bashar, but it wasn't allowed to happen. Now, if we also look at the other thing, on the Golan Heights, there was oil and gas, massive amounts of oil and gas. The Golan Heights are occupied by Israel. It's an occupied territory. Now, under Article 4 of the Geneva Convention on Occupied Territories, you're not allowed to exploit the minerals of an occupied territory. The Israelis have now got American oil companies exploiting the oil and gas. And they want to run a pipeline across Syria, which Assad is not going to allow. So is there, in these machinations, is there an awful lot more than the ordinary person is being allowed to see?
Now, I think it's a good time to bring in a certain journalist I've got a lot of time and respect for. I have done over many, many years, and he appeared on the Going Underground show this week.
John Pilger, an incredible man, an incredible man. I met him in Vietnam on two occasions. You won't ever remember me, but I was just a floating person. But what an incredible person John Pilger
anyway,
is. What a truthful journalist.
Let's have a listen now to some words on the Going Underground show John Pilger had to say, and let's get him on, please, on Channel 4 News, can we, one night, or News Night? Come on, the Russians can do it. I'm sure we can manage it. Let's have a listen to John Pilger now, anyway.
You quote in your updated article, which harks back to the bombing of Cambodia to explain events today, you quote the former French Foreign Minister Roland Dumas saying that British officials in London were talking to him about Cameron's support for regime change, for destabilising Syria. Would you appeal to someone to leak that information? He said he couldn't go into more detail because for fear of litigation himself.
Yeah, well, that was 2013. Dumas, in an interview on French television, said that he was happened to be in England, and he was invited in to see people in the government and asked if he would like to take part in a project they had, and that project was an attack on Syria. But, you know, that's 2013. We can go back to the 1950s when the British intelligence was plotting the end of the regime in Syria. Syria's main crime is that it is independent, and it stands against Israel dominating that part of the world. It stands with, these days, with Iran. It stands with the other opponents, Hezbollah, now with Russia. There is no question that if there was an election tomorrow, all those minorities that look to this government in Damascus for all its violations of human rights, and no one doubts those, look to it as its protector, because the alternative is ISIS. And everything the West has done has been to create first the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, then with the invasion of Iraq in 2003, then in 2011, the invasion and destruction of Libya. That probably was the crucial, that was the turning point. The French, the British, the Americans, less so in this adventure, was mainly the French and the British. Since then, Hollande has sold, openly sold, arms to Jabhat al-Nusra. The arms of French rocket launchers have ended up with ISIS. This year in April, it did $7 billion deal for French jets with Qatar, and it did a $12 billion deal in June with Saudi Arabia.
Well, that's a pretty good summary, isn't it, of the actual situation?
That's a brilliant summary. I mean, from John Pilger, you cannot get a better analyst, reporter, and a very straightforward and truthful man.
Now, John, it does make you wonder, doesn't it, whether we're getting a load of propaganda over here if people like his voices are not being heard.
Yeah, we are getting a heck of a lot of propaganda here, Tony. It's being corrupted, it's being bent. The intelligence agencies, ACIA, are assisting ISIS on the ground over there.
I mean, what are your thoughts about the way that the media is co-opted in times like this when they're trying to get these votes in Parliament for bombing Syria?
Well, quite honestly, I think 99% of our mainstream media, A, are run by Murdoch, B, do what they're told, and C, don't want to rock the boat.
I think that's true, and I think John Pilger is an exceptional journalist.
Exceptional.
But I think what we do on this show, of course, is...
It's also exceptional because you're rubbing the mainstream media up the wrong way. Well,
indeed, and we also, Tony and myself, also do work with Russia Today and Press TV. But I think the key thing that makes us do what we do is questioning, for example, what happened in Paris, coming back to that. Because if we are correct in our supposition that this is a Gladio-style attack, that means that the Western intelligence services, possibly the Israelis, possibly the French, are actually killing their own people as part of the process of trying to start a war in a foreign country.
Well, that is
actually an extremely much harder... they're not just manipulating and propagandising, they are terrorising.
John, give us your thoughts as to why you think it is possible that the Western states, NATO, etc., might even be killing people in Paris just to get their political ends. The idea being to blame
it
on their enemy.
Al-Baghdadi, the leader of ISIS, and several of his senior officers were in Camp Bukhara in Iraq up until 2007. Al-Baghdadi was given access to all three of the camps within Camp Bukhara, all three separate camps where there was Al-Qaeda, criminals, and minor politicals, but he had access to all three. When he left Camp Bukhara in 2007, he was flown up to Erbil in an American military helicopter. It was flown from Erbil to Tel Aviv in a Black Ops aircraft, delivered to Mossad. Mossad trained him. Now, the Americans brought him back in through the Golan Heights, or the Israelis brought him back in through the Golan Heights into Syria. He was given $25 million, and this is all fact and it's all checkable, Tony. He was given money, $25 million, and he was also given all the prisoners that were released out of the Saudi jails, the murderers and the ones who are facing execution, etc., etc., were told, you go with these guys, you're pardoned, and that's it. And if you remember, the Saudi jails were emptied to the start of ISIS.
One of the things does make you wonder, doesn't it, who gains out of all this? And this is one of the questions which...
Who gains?
One of the questions which was asked by Afshan Rashani on going underground to John Pilger too. So let's hear his answer to that.
Well, the people who are killed in Paris are not winning, are they? And the people who are killed in Palestine are not winning. And the people who were killed by ISIS in Beirut, who the media all but ignored, are not winning. So all those people who suffer and are maimed, all those 700,000 widows in Iraq, they're certainly not winning. It has to stop. And in my view, it will only stop when people force their governments to stop. Now, how that is done, I can't really say, but that certainly is the only solution that is left to us now.
John?
100%.
Martin, how do we get our governments to stop?
Well, I'm very depressed at the moment because I'm a member of the Labour Party, and many Labour MPs seem to have been completely bamboozled by this propaganda offensive and by what's happened in Paris. And I've got Dan Jarvis, who's ex-military Labour MP, was saying that he's now finally convinced that we've got to bomb Syria, and we've got to get rid of Assad as well because he chemically weaponed his own people, even though the evidence is overwhelming that the Al-Nusra Front carried out the chemical weapons attack, with sarin provided from Libya via MIT in Turkey. And he's an MP, and he's in the position to decide on peace or war, and he hasn't bothered to look at the basic facts that are out there that you and I know off the back of our hand. And these people are the people in charge. They just go for mood music. I think some people in the Labour Party actually think that it's more important to snub Jeremy Corbyn over this than to analyse what actually happened in Paris, or to think about the consequences of the RAF going head-to-head with the Russian Air Force.
Well, talking about the consequences, John, I'll give you the final word now. US NATO versus Russia war could be the end of humanity. So what do we do about this? What are your thoughts?
Well, basically, the people have now got to stand up and say, that is it, that is enough, you've got to stop this, and the vote has got to go, no confidence vote has got to go on the government, because if we do go to war, if NATO goes to war with Russia, we're all finished. There's no two ways about it. It will wipe out humanity. I mean, if we look at Trident, why are we improving Trident when if a nuclear war starts, the UK's gone. Russia's not worried about Trident because Russia's got plenty of land to be safe on, but the UK's going to be a barren wasteland in about 3 minutes.
Well, counter-terrorism officer, former counter-terrorism officer, John Banks, thanks very much for joining us on The Politics Show.
Well, thank you very much, Tony. Thanks a lot, Martin.
You can listen again to any shows at bcfmradio.com.
And leave comments about your favourite programmes.
BCFM 93.2, your interactive station, 24 hours a day.
Martin, one of the side issues to that is the state of emergency declared in Crimea this week after activists blew up electricity pylons. So this is all sort of hotting up, isn't it, between Russia and Turkey in that part of the world around the Black Sea.
Yeah, well, the blowing up of the electricity pylons cut off the electricity supply to the Crimea, and it happened on the same day, I think, as the shoot down of the Su-24. And now Crimean Tatar activists are preventing, supposedly, the authorities in Ukraine from putting the electricity back on in Crimea. Now, in other words, that we're getting escalation both on the Eastern Front, as it were, in Ukraine, and escalation on the Southern Front in Turkey/Syria/Kurdistan. The Russians, to their great credit, are being very, very calm about everything. They're calling a spade. Lavrov, who doesn't use words lightly, said this was a deliberate provocation. They deliberately shot our plane down. We know they did that, but we have no intention of going to war with them. I think the obvious thing that may well happen, of course, is that don't forget the Turkish army is already bombing inside Iraq, again against international law, the basis of the PKK. The PKK's political wing has managed to make it into the Turkish parliament. They've virtually got 100% political support in the Kurdish regions of Turkey. And just like Kosovo, there could be an independent Kurdistan. And we will go to war with who to stop this? Will we be fighting with the Turks to stop the PKK? Or will we be fighting with the PKK against ISIS? And I think if anybody's deciding next week to vote in favour of war in Syria, it might be viable, provided you gave up the idea of overthrowing Assad. But if they want to keep the idea of overthrowing Assad and go to war with ISIS, that makes no sense at all, and we're on the road to disaster.
The other aspect to all of this, of course, is what I mentioned at the top of the hour, which is the possibility of regime change in Moscow. The Americans actually wanting a confrontation, possibly a nuclear confrontation with the Russians. Now, we know back from the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962 that there were US hawks, the General Power, Curtis Lee May, these people that the Dr. Strangelove film was based on, that really did want a nuclear war. The quote being, we can win this war with no more than expectable, that is tens or even hundreds of millions of casualties.
Well, do you know what? I'm usually terribly pessimistic and doom and gloom, but I don't think there is going to be a nuclear war, because I think both the Russians are quite capable of defending themselves in a nuclear sense. So the provocation of putting missile defence systems into Poland and Romania and so on, the Russians are well able to deal with that by simply using nuclear submarines to go round it. But of course, the Americans love war because it makes money for the American corporations, Lockheed Martin, etc. Now, if there is a nuclear war, then all bets are off. But I think what we are going to find is a conventional war will take place all the way up to nuclear war. Now, the people who will start a nuclear war will be NATO, because they're going to lose a conventional war against Russia in the Eastern Mediterranean and on the Eastern Front. If we have a conventional war, they will lose. So they'll be the ones who will have to go to nuclear to try and salvage the situation.
Well, there's a website called Space for Peace, and it's cannot go through. It's quite a long-winded organisation, but it's about anti-weapons in space, basically. And from Maine, I spoke to Bruce Gagnon as part of our Dialect show earlier this week, and he runs this Space for Peace website, and there's a whole organisation in the US which is getting very, very worried about the US wish to completely dominate space, and that's why it's very closely linked in with this missile defence shield. The idea being, as soon as there is any kind of first strike by the United States, if that was to take place, the missile defence shield would be then used and readied to take out any retaliation from the Russians. As you were saying, Martin, possibly submarine missiles might be able to go around that. But anyway, I was quite shocked to see that the US Pentagon is actually planning possibly to have a first strike on Moscow, possibly even also Beijing too. So here's Bruce Gagnon now from Space for Peace.
Well, what's up there today is a slew of military satellites that direct all warfare on the planet, so the U.S. can see everything, can hear everything, and can target every place on the Earth below. And with that technology, they now have an advantage over every other country. They can direct soldiers on the ground, people in tanks, people in planes, people on boats, to their targets with this military space technology.
I mean, surely the Chinese, the Russians, they've got their satellites up there too. There's no, the Americans might want to dominate space, but they don't have a monopoly up there.
No, they don't, but they sure have a tremendous advantage. And now the United States is deploying so-called missile defense systems encircling both Russia and China. And missile defense is a key element in U.S. first strike attack planning. The idea is that you would hit them first in a first strike attack when they tried to fire their remaining retaliatory capability. So-called missile defense systems would take them out. So the U.S. formally was involved with Russia in the ABM treaty, anti-ballistic missile treaty, that excluded and outlawed these so-called missile defense systems. But when George W. Bush became president, he walked away from that treaty. And since that time, Obama has escalated the program dramatically. And we now see today both Russia and China saying that all negotiations for nuclear disarmament are off as long as the U.S. continues surrounding both those countries with missile defense.
But that's on the ground, the missile defense system. What's the connection with what's going on up way above the Earth?
Well, missile defense doesn't work unless you have satellite lights that can direct it to its target, unless you have ground stations like up at Fylingdales and Menwith Hill in Yorkshire that can direct it to its target. So all of this space technology fits together into a seamless web. And again, the United States is much further along than anyone else. There are really no competitors to the U.S. today. And the U.S. has demonstrated in the past that it has anti-satellite weapons capability, the ability to destroy other countries' satellites, and also leads today in cyber warfare, which allows essentially the U.S. to try to shut off other countries' computers before they're attacked so that they're not able to have their early warning systems in place so they don't see the U.S. coming. This is what the U.S. did in Yugoslavia. Just some years ago.
So what did they do in Yugoslavia, Bruce?
They shut down the air defense system, so they were not able to protect themselves when NATO warplanes bombed Yugoslavia. Not one NATO warplane was lost in that so-called war. So clearly the advantage of cyber warfare there gave the U.S. and NATO a clear ability to play cat and mouse, if you will.
So what about the shooting down of satellites or disabling them? How is that done? Is it done from other satellites or from the ground?
Well, right now they have the ability to do it from the ground, but they also are putting in place systems like the X-37B, a military space plane that has demonstrated it has the ability to stay in orbit for a year at a time, and it would be able to go up and essentially wipe out another country's satellite while it's orbiting the Earth.
That's Bruce Gagnon there from the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space.
Well, the idea that they are planning to fight a nuclear war is clear. They are planning to fight a nuclear war.
What's the point of having nuclear weapons if you're not?
Well, no. Well, in the past, we were told that both sides had got nuclear weapons and there was mutually assured destruction, so that nobody actually made a conscious plan to plan for nuclear war. They were just, you know, they were there as a kind of insurance policy for both sides. But, of course, what began to happen from the 1980s, we know from 1983, and people can check this, that we nearly had a nuclear war when we were demonstrating against cruise missiles being deployed in Britain, and that there was a danger of a nuclear war because of the belligerence of the Reagan and Thatcher regimes. The then regime in the Soviet Union was absolutely paranoid, and they nearly pressed the button by mistake in 1983 because they thought they were being attacked. We nearly it was a whole Cuban Missile Crisis that nearly happened, and most people didn't even realise it. And of course, they only in the end did they stop being paranoid because they had a spy at the top of NATO in Brussels who basically then told them that they were bluffing and they weren't going to attack. But the Russians thought that they were. And in fact, if you start threatening people and threatening to attack them, we're going to attack you, the danger is that you're not that they take you at your word and hit you first.
So I spoke also to Bruce Gagnon from the website that the organization Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space, and also www.spaceforpeace.org, and I asked him about what were the Americans' goals in having all these weapons in space.
I think the United States' goal is to take Russia down and take China down. Recently I saw a video interview, a speech by George Friedman, the founder and chief executive officer of Stratfor, which is the sort of the privatized CIA. They brief private corporations, give them intelligence information. He called for the taking down of both Moscow and Beijing. Why Russia? Why take down Russia? Well, because they have the world's largest supply of natural gas. And don't we know by now that the Pentagon's number one job in the world is to serve as the primary resource extraction service for corporate globalization? And then secondly, as we see climate change, we see the melting of the Arctic ice. What country has the largest land border with the Arctic Ocean? Well, that happens to be Russia. And the oil corporations want to get up into the Arctic and drill, baby, drill. And so according to Friedman and also the RAND Corporation in California, that's a long-known military think tank, the idea is to balkanize Russia, break it up into constituent pieces, so that they would have an easier chance to then get in and extract resources, both on the ground and from the Arctic Sea in the coming years. So this is the project. And so they're starting with, they started with Libya. Libya has the largest supply of gas on the African continent. U.S. and NATO took down Libya. Now they're trying to take down Syria. Iran is on the agenda, and then Russia. And then, as I said, China as well. So today we see a NATO expansion on steroids creeping up to the Russian border, violating promises that were made to the former Soviet Union when the Berlin Wall fell, that NATO would not expand one centimeter to the east. But Bill Clinton and a succession of U.S. presidents have violated that promise. So Russia today is looking at the Earth from their space satellites, and they see themselves being surrounded, as does China. And I believe that this current situation in Syria and the Turkish shooting down of a Russian airplane is one more effort on the part of NATO to create a war with Russia.
But, I mean, are they crazy, Bruce? Because, I mean, a nuclear war it would be if it was with Russia and China.
I believe they are crazy, in fact. The people that control the United States government today are not the citizens of the United States, but, in fact, it's a criminal syndicate, a corporate criminal syndicate full of psychotic operatives that work for corporations that are blind to human suffering. And we've seen what they've done in Iraq. We've seen what they've done in Afghanistan. We've seen what they've been doing in eastern Ukraine, where the Kiev junta, the puppet government in Kiev, controlled by the United States, has been shelling their own citizens, killing thousands of them, innocent people. So, you know, we've seen what the U.S. government has been doing in Syria. We've seen what they do with drones in many different countries, killing scores and scores and scores of innocent people. So clearly, my government is out of control, and anybody that misses that is not really paying attention.
What are the American people doing to sort out their own government, Bruce?
I think they're very depressed. They're very saddened, and sadly, too, they're also under, many of them are under the control of the corporate-dominated media, just as in your country, where you have a scandalous media that is run by the likes of Rupert Murdoch. Our media is also run by corporate interests who keep people distracted with entertainment and hysterical fear-mongering stories. So that's the reality of our country. We do have a peace movement that has been largely demobilized by the Obama administration. Liberal Democrats in this country are afraid to speak out against their own president for fear that he would be replaced by someone worse. But in fact, it's my opinion that Obama has done the very same things that George W. Bush was doing, in fact, even worse, but at the same time offered the corporate oligarchy that runs our country the added advantage of having demobilized much of the left. So this is where we are today. And those of us that still remain active in the peace movement are scrambling, trying to do our best under a difficult situation.
Bruce, just remind us about where your website is, where people can follow some of your more of your work online. And I'd also like to know, actually, maybe before you answer that, what role do you think these sorts of attacks like the 9/11, the 7/7, London bombings and the Paris attacks have in all of this?
Well, you know, I've become a student in the last year or so of the whole Gladio operation after World War II, the U.S. NATO operation to create terrorist incidents throughout Europe as a way to blame them on the left to keep socialists and communists out of power. In fact, if you go onto YouTube and just Google BBC documentary Gladio, G-L-A-D-I-O, you see a wonderful BBC story that unearths the whole Gladio operation. So I think that what we saw in Paris, what would happen on 9/11, are these Gladio-style false flags. There's no doubt in my mind about it. I would suggest people, again, go to our website, spaceforpeace.org. That's the global network against weapons and nuclear power in space. And also, I have a blog that I post to pretty much every day, especially when I'm traveling. I want people to know what I'm doing around the world. And that is called Organizing Notes. And you can find it from our website, spaceforpeace.org, or just Google Organizing Notes along with my name, Bruce Gagnon, and you should find it.
And you should find it. That's Bruce Gagnon from the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space. And as he said, the website www.space4peace.org. Martin, one of the things he mentioned there was the drones, the use of the satellites for targeting for drones. And we hear this week the drone pilots have bank accounts and credit cards frozen by the feds for exposing U.S. murder. Now, this is the drone pilot whistleblowers have just had all their money frozen.
Well, we've got an increasingly totalitarian reality, haven't we? Where people who do speak out, who have been involved in things like drone killings, are going to be persecuted. And that's just the world we live in, isn't it?
Well, I mean, what can we do about it? What can they do about it, for example? I mean, I suppose we should just find out what they're saying and maybe even email it.
Telling the truth in a time of universal deceit is a revolutionary act. Because the truth is like acid. It'll cut through anything in the end, as long as people are open to it.
Okay, very briefly, we've had attacks in Mali this time last week, and also others in Africa. And I hear the German soldiers are being sent to help the French in Africa now.
Well, I think a lot of these attacks, we know that basically Al-Qaeda and its offshoots are basically intelligence assets of the Western intelligence services. So, as we were saying earlier, many of these attacks are actually at the door of CIA, MI6, Mossad. Those people need to be sent to prison for a very long time.
Time to sign off now. The Murdoch News at 7 o'clock. Thanks to our guests in the first hour, Deputy Mayor and Conservative Councillor for Westbury-on-Trim, Jeff Gollop. Our sister show Dialect's been dropped from BCFM by the Chair and the Management, but it's still available as a podcast. This week, we have a special on St Paul's Carnival and the history of Bristol through the medieval times and the slave trade, as well as a full report on the US domination of space and satellite warfare. If you're online, you can download this week's show on www.dialectradio1word.co.uk. Thanks to Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. thisweek.org.uk takes you straight to this show's links and the archives. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for the politics show at 5 o'clock next week, and please don't let those banksters get you down.
This is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.